Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Trevor Burrus.
And I'm Aaron Powell.
Joining us today is John Mueller, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. He is also a member of the Political Science Department and senior research scientist with the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. His new book is The Stupidity of War, American Foreign Policy and the Case for Complacency. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Your title is provocative in two ways. First, how is war stupid?
Well, I think war has always been stupid. Depends on your values, obviously. But it only became, people basically didn't come to really realize that until the 20th century. In other words, it wasn't that there were the occasional people saying, war is really stupid, it's ugly, it's disgusting, and so forth. But it was countered previously, before World War I, by the notion that war is really beautiful, glorious, clean, cleansing, redemptive, progressive, and that peace was decadent and filled with bovine content, as one person put it. It was only after World War I, I think, that there was this really broad consensus that it was really basically stupid, the kind of thing that people basically agree now. But if you said that before the war, you'd be shouted down by all these people who said how wonderful war was. And the only thing peace was good for was to maintain get ready for the next war. War was extremely common. We're talking basically about international war and war in Europe in particular. And so there's a huge change in attitudes in war toward war at the time of World War I. Because and you can see that quantitatively. It's very easy to find people saying the things I've just been saying before World War I. It's virtually impossible to find anybody saying that after the war. So it goes from a lot, hundreds, thousands, I can give you thousands of examples, to virtually zero. So that my thesis is that it's very consequential.
Given what you've just said, I guess I'm a little bit confused about what you mean by a consensus that war is stupid, because not too long ago, we recorded an episode of this podcast with our colleague, John Glazer, on the way that the Washington foreign policy establishment works. And the Washington foreign policy establishment seems to be filled with lots of people who certainly don't act as if war is stupid. They're always calling for us to get into new wars, to stay in existing wars, to escalate, and looking down their noses at those of us who say, you know, maybe we should disengage a bit. Maybe we shouldn't use quite as much kinetic military action. So are those people exceptions to the consensus that war is stupid, or do they mean something? Is there something else going on?
No, basically what you're talking about is military action, actually being prepared for war and using it around the fringes. But essentially, there's only been two international wars in this whole century. Both of them started by the kind of people you're talking about, incidentally, the 9/11 wars against Afghanistan and against Iraq, both of which degenerated. If you look at Europe as a whole, for example, since World War II, there has not been a single substantial international war in a continent that used to be the most warlike in the world. And in fact, Europe has now been free from international war for the longest period of time since the word Europe was invented about 2,500 years ago. So I think that's consequential. What you do have is playing around at the fringes. As I say, basically, there's hardly anything resembling real international wars anymore, particularly in the last few decades. But you do have people playing around in the sense of intervening in each other's civil wars. You do have economic sanctions. You do have lobbing cyber balloons. So there's various things like that you can do, but they're all short of war by my standard. A war, in my opinion, the way it's commonly defined, is a conflict between an international war, conflict between two countries in which at least 1,000 battle deaths are suffered per year. You also get, there's also a fair number of little dinky wars, if that's what you want to call them. For example, there was just a border conflict a few months ago between China and India, in which about a dozen people died. If you count that as a war, then obviously that's a war. But what's impressive since 1945, and particularly in the last two, three decades, is that although there have been border conflicts, the people doing the conflicts keep them very limited and keep them from escalating to a real war. So they tend to take place in places where there's nobody, no people along border lines, and also where there's no garrisons. So the idea is not so much that warlike behavior is completely gone, but wars are. And so we've got sort of an anarchic situation in which, the way I'd put it basically, is overwhelmingly people have states, there's a sort of a culture of peace in the world, culture of a society of peace, in which the states essentially agree not to use war as an instrument to carry out their policy, international war. At one time, it was a standard way of doing things. So that's really a major development. And it's been growing since 1945. In 1945, Europe and mostly in the developed world generally basically slumped into a lack of war. I mean, there's been no World War III, right? I'm safe on that one, I hope. Gradually, other countries around the world have fallen into step. For example, there are a fair number of wars between Israel and the Arab states, international wars, but the last one is in 1973. And there also were fairly substantial wars between India and Pakistan, but the last one of those was basically about that same time. There have been exceptions, the Iran-Iraq war. There was a war between Ethiopia and Eritrea at the very end of the 20th century, but they've been really quite low. There have been a lot of civil wars, and at one time there were colonial wars, but those died out with colonialism. So what we're dealing with is this society. So from a libertarian standpoint, it's sort of a perfect anarchy, almost perfect, imperfect anarchy, in which there is no government. And countries around the world need to work out their problems. I mean, they have disputes over borders. They have disputes over fisheries. They have disputes over trade. They have disputes over ethnic groups and stuff. And what they have, if they've truly given up the idea of using war to deal with them, they have to work out rules and regulations, laws. How far does the, how far into the sea does the territorial, is part of the territory of the country next to it? That kind of thing. But I think mostly what's happened is that the rules have come from the aversion to war. I'll give you a pedestrian example here, literally pedestrian, I guess. We have a rule that you should only ride on one side of the street. In Washington, that'd be the right side of the street. London, the left. Now, it is not the case that people have become averse to being killed by oncoming traffic because they have to drive on one side of the street. Rather, the aversion to being killed by oncoming traffic has led to the rule. And so what you can do is, so you can basically get that worked out. It doesn't matter what side you pick, but everybody has to go along with it. And if the occasional misguided drunk drives on the wrong side, that doesn't invalidate the rule. So I think generally it's not that rules have been set up that have caused peace, but the desire for peace has caused the rules.
Now, it seems you pinpointed World War I, which it has a few characteristics to it, the sort of mechanization of death, things like tanks, and sort of the astounding brutality of some of these things, in addition to a lot of pictures and images coming from the war, and then, of course, the massive death tolls. So it seems that there might be a fairly easy explanation for this, like massive war technologies being used on a massive scale became much less desirable than cavalry charges between Napoleonic, in the Napoleonic Wars. Basically, the brutality of war increased, and so the desire for it decreased.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think basically simply became repulsed by it. Dysentery, to bring up probably the most common attribute of war, wasn't invented in 1914. Neither were mud nor leeches. And if you want to be killed, being shot by a bullet is probably a lot better than being hacked to death with a sword or penetrated with an arrow. So basically, people for a long time, the disgusting aspect of war has been there for a long time. And what happened after World War I was that people were willing to see it. So they said, basically, let's not do that again. That also happened with slavery 100 years earlier. People started jumping up and down saying we shouldn't do slavery anymore, even though it was economically doing quite well. The Atlantic slave trade was booming. And the same thing with dueling. Dueling is a way for centuries, a way of men of a certain class working out their disagreements. By the end of the 19th century, it was regarded to be silly, stupid, ridiculous. And I think that's basically what happened with war. I mean, World War I obviously was a horrible catastrophe, but there are plenty of wars, you know, that were fought to total annihilation before that. There are plenty of wars that were fought for things which are even more stupid. I mean, the most famous war in history or mythology is the one between the Greeks and the Trojans. It was fought over an errant wife, lasted 10 years, and ended up with Troy being totally annihilated. The men killed, the women sold into sexual slavery, and the place burned to the ground. So the 30 Years' War in Europe was devastating. There's a rumor for a long time, a belief for a long time, that 80 or 90% of the Germans died in it. That turns out that was high, but people believed that. And no one said, that was really bad, let's not do that anymore. Instead, they just kept going and assumed it was a way of life. So before World War I is unique in only one respect that I can see, and that's that there was a peace movement, anti-war movement, organized for the first time in history. I mean, individual philosophers sitting on rocks saying war is a bad idea and so forth, but this is the first time there was an organized movement, and it was mostly ridiculed by it, and it was a gadfly movement. But it was attracting a fair amount of attention from politicians, from financiers like Alfred Nobel and Andrew Carnegie. And socialists had it sort of built in somewhat too. So it was kind of a growing movement, but it was basically ridiculed as being effeminate and cowardly and materialistic. After the war, the arguments were the standard coin. And so there's this concentrated effort to try to stop international wars from happening again.
What exactly changed with the perception then? Because if it isn't, as Trevor hypothesized, an increase in the brutality of war, and we certainly had, you know, yes, there were photographs and some videos in the way that there hadn't necessarily been with, you know, the 30 Years' War or the Trojan War, but there still were accounts of the war, right? Like even Homer talks a fair bit about the brutality of the Trojan War. Like we weren't hiding that. So what changed that suddenly made with World War I people willing to accept the brutality of war and willing to see it in a way that they hadn't been before?
Well, I've got a three-word answer. I don't know. There is a phrase, ideas whose time has come. Democracy started in big countries only about 200 years ago, 250 years ago. Democracy was known about for millennia. And then suddenly, starting with the United States, Switzerland, Britain, and so forth, just started doing it. It wasn't a new idea. And so why didn't that start 500 years before that or 1,000 years before that? It didn't, except in small enclaves. So I can definitely guarantee what I've said earlier, quantitatively, that before World War I, there are all these people saying this. I can give you chapter and verse over and over again. These are not just woolly militarists from Prussia, but they're philosophers, poets. I mean, Emile Zola, the French novelist, called war life itself. And there's a philosopher, art critic. In Britain, basically saying, you know, the world, you know, we can't get rid of war because it's so wonderful. So it was just very common. It was necessary. Igor Stravinsky, the composer, saying it's necessary for human progress. It's just sort of accepted. Starting after the war, you can find almost nobody that says that. Let me give you actually an example. I found the book. Actually, the book is mostly written. and then I came across this, so I certainly put it in. Someone on Wikipedia has put a list of all the anti-war plays, plays historically, which have been anti-war in their basic color. They got three plays for the ancient Greeks, two by Aristophanes and one by Euripides. And the next one is 1929. I think they skip over, I would take Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida as being an anti-war play, but they may have made a few mistakes here and there. But basically, then after the war, you know, the second most popular film, silent film of the silent era was Gore Vidal's King Vidor's The Big Parade, which is an anti-war film. It made tons of money. A novel like All Quiet on the Western Front, late in the 20s, a German novel, becomes a bestseller. So basically everybody's against war. And that's mostly continued.
One of the interesting things about wars, maybe intermittently, but it's quite common for when the war begins, it is perceived to be easy by some sides, that, you know, World War One would happen and, you know, the Brits would go over to the continent and, you know, give Jerry a drumming and come back home by Christmas. And the Civil War has a similar type of thing where the North doesn't think the South wants to fight and vice versa. One exception to that, however, is World War II. And that's part of a general thing is World War II kind of an exception, broadly speaking, from this? Because if we had established the stupidity of war, realized that we marched off unknowingly between 1914 and 1918 into the tunes of, you know, millions dead. But then World War II comes, and that seems to be a non-stupid war that people went into knowing it would not be easy and it would cost a lot of lives, but it needed to be done.
Yeah. My book basically deals with since 1945, but the one place where the militarism lasted was in Japan. You can still find when I said before, basically you can't find it anywhere. You can find it in Japan, but not anyplace else. Certainly not in Europe. So they were sort of primed for it, and of course they stumbled into this war themselves, trying to with an invasion of China and so forth. The other war, and this is a very controversial part of the book, but I'll stand by it. I've been working on it for some time. Was that World War II in Europe would not have started had it not been for Adolf Hitler. That is to say, if you want to find somebody who really made a difference, it was him. It's very hard to see any other German. They had resentments and stuff from World War One. You know, all that. That's all certainly true. But the idea of going to war to relieve it was simply not acceptable. John Keegan, one of the major military historians, said after World War One there was only one European who wanted war, and that was Adolf Hitler. And I've looked at it quite extensively. The question is, if he'd been run over by a truck, was there someone else that would do it? And there basically wasn't anybody. There's stuff about German public opinion. And the German public was as afraid of another war as the French or the Dutch or the English. So Hitler was a world's, I once called him the history's supreme atavism. But anyway, then after the war, that reifies everything. Once again, now instead of the League of Nations, you have the United Nations, you have outlawing of war coming in. You have millions of treaties and stuff to try to keep it that way. So in some respects, World War One is a cosmic disaster, but the one in Europe in particular was not a stupid war. It was necessary probably to do something about him. Though he mostly self-destructed by massively overreaching, but it also reified the idea we shouldn't do international war anymore, particularly in Europe.
And then shortly after World War II, we get into Korea. And as you said, your book mostly focuses on post-45. Now, Korea stands interestingly in the kind of Cold War story is that it might have been justified, at least in the sense that at least half that peninsula is not living under one of the worst and most despotic regimes we've ever seen. But was there something a little bit overwrought about Korea and the way that we perceived what was going on there?
Yes, I think so in many respects. What happened was, you know, I mentioned before that people were using non-military or non-warlike devices. And in the case of Korea, the communist world definitely was not status quo. It definitely wanted to change things. It wanted to take over the world, if you want to call it that. But its techniques were not used to use a direct war. It was to use revolution. And they've said this a billion times, revolutionary civil wars, subversion, that kind of thing. And they certainly tried that, particularly by beefing up the communist parties in France and Italy, for example. But that was not starting a direct war by any means. The exception to that was when Kim Il-sung comes in and says, I'm sitting up here in North Korea, a communist state, mostly fabricated by the Russians, Soviets, and I can take over South Korea. And so by military force, by pushing. And the Stalin in Russia was actually quite reluctant to get into this mess. He pulled back the Soviet troops so they wouldn't, if it escalated, the Soviet Union would not be pulled into it. And it turned into this disastrous war. The United States saying, I think, much overestimating the issue, arguing that it was showing that the revolutionaries were not willing to use direct war. And it seems to me this is a sort of a unique, bizarre case at that time in an area which was extremely, very much a backwater. It isn't anymore, but it was then. But the interpretation was that if we don't fight there, we're going to have to fight World War III. That was almost precise quote from Harry Truman. The problem was the Korean War may be the only war that was worth fighting that the United States has done since World War II, in my opinion. But the problem was that there was an extrapolation from that, arguing that we have to really deter in a war by the Soviet Union, like against Western Europe. In fact, a lot of people at the time thought that the attack on Korea is a diversionary tactic, and they're really going to come across the fill the gap and take over Western Europe. Complete nonsense, but who knows at that time. But then the idea that you had to deter the Soviet Union from starting war, document after document coming out of the Soviet archives indicates that was nonsense. They never in a million years wanted to get into anything that'd be like World War One or World War II, much less one with nuclear weapons. The archives show that they had no plans for any kind of offensive wars. They did have plans in case they were attacked themselves. So there's basically a massive exaggeration of the threat that the Soviet Union placed. They were right to suggest they wanted to support their revolution, coups, revolutionary civil war, but they're wrong to think that it was going to use a major war, direct old-fashioned war, international war, in other words, to advance the cause.
But we don't have, at the moment that we are thinking about declaring a war or engaging in a war, we don't have access to the archives of the people that we might be going to war against. And so a lot of this seems like there are, most wars are stupid, but you've listed some that weren't or maybe weren't. But how do we know going in if a war is stupid or not? I mean, we can tell after the fact when we've, assessed all the information, but we've got to make a decision right now. Are there important signs we can look for to say this war is leaning in the stupid direction?
Well, my argument basically is people come to agree that all international wars are stupid. And so they don't start them. I mean, the point is that we haven't had any, had very few international wars since World War II. Of any sort, any place in the world, in a declining number, and almost zero in this century already. So essentially, you can certainly see that in the public opinion. And do we really want to get into a war with Iran, for example? I think that's the response is no, definitely not. So generally speaking, there's been issues, there've been problems, there've been border conflicts, and so forth. But people said, what we don't want to do is get into a situation which escalates to a real war. Occasionally, there have been some wars, of course, since World War II, international wars, but they've been really quite rare. So my argument is that those wars didn't seem stupid necessarily to the guy starting them at the beginning. But mostly what's happened is anytime you bring up the idea of war, the response is, that's really stupid. Let's not do that. In other words, we want to take over some of my, Costa Rica's territory. Well, we'll do it by diverting a river, and we'll do it in a place where there isn't any people and where there isn't any garrison, and where they basically can get away with it because they don't really care about that territory anyway. So we can nip off things, or we can poach somebody's fish. or we can exact economic sanctions. There's various things we can do. But these are seen to be an alternative to war, suggesting essentially that using real war, which was used to be common currency in the olden days, before 1914 in Europe in particular, is no longer an acceptable means. An analogy with dueling. I mean, why don't young men duel anymore? I mean, you could even do it legally, like with boxing gloves. But now what you get is a situation in which they have the same disagreements. I don't think there's any evidence that testosterone levels have gone down. They still get mad over various matters of honor and being disrespected and so forth, and particularly over women. But they don't even think about fighting a duel over it. Now, what that can do is increase incivility. In other words, if you go, you know, if you're in the dueling class and you walk up to somebody at a fancy costume ball and say, "You're a bloody liar," or as happens in Tolstoy's novel, War and Peace, "Your wife has been sleeping around," what you can expect would be, in the old days, you'd be challenged to a duel. So therefore, you might say, even though everybody knows that's true, what you were saying, that going to the duels might have unpleasant consequences. So you'd be deterred from going from insulting this guy for the fear that you might be called into a duel. Now that's gone away. So now you can walk up and say, "Your wife has been sleeping around." There might be some consequences, like you might take a poke in your mouth, poke you in the face, or he might try to sue you, or he might try to denigrate you outside and so forth. All kinds of things, slander, et cetera, whatever. So you can do all those kinds of uncivil things, but basically you don't have to worry about being into a duel. And I think that's basically what's happening with war. People can be intemperate. Certainly they've intervened in other people's civil wars, which usually didn't happen. But they don't get into wars directly themselves, international wars.
You seem, very confident, going a little back to Aaron's question, that during the Cold War, during this time when the American foreign policy establishment assumed that the Soviet Union was hell-bent on expansion, even via military expansion, and that it would be a domino theory. It would sort of take over if you had Mexico become a communist satellite state. That was going to be bad for America. Everyone thought this at the time, which is interesting for your thesis, because it both assumes maybe that is your argument being that we thought that the USSR really wanted war and the USSR thought that we wanted war. But actually both of us had learned that war was stupid, even with or without nuclear weapons, but definitely with nuclear weapons.
Yeah. And well, that's basically what happened. It's called the security dilemma. And it's, some people call it a tragedy. I think it's more like a farce. I do something to protect myself against you, and you get thinking that, well, the reason he's doing that is because he wants to start a war, so therefore we have to arm and so forth. The containment idea that they might take over countries was perfectly plausible. They took over, obviously, the communist advance in Cuba. They took over North Vietnam. They obviously took over China in 1949 and so forth. But that was part of their game plan. Marxism, Leninism was the wave of the future and so forth. But what happened was, almost comically, as in retrospect, was that containment. And so the idea basically was to have containment to keep these people from advancing. And then they'd eventually mellow from within, was the idea. Well, what happened was the opposite. Namely, after 1975, a whole bunch of countries suddenly fell into the communist orbit. Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia in Southeast Asia, three countries in Africa, a couple in Latin America, South Yemen, and then Afghanistan. And all these countries descended, and so they joined the Soviet Empire willingly, or the Soviet camp. And what happened was that the Soviets then found that they almost all turned into economic and political and often military basket cases filled with civil war, the worst one being Afghanistan. So the Soviet Union came to realize that they would have been better off contained. At first, they thought the correlation of forces, as they called it, was really moving in their direction. And so they're really happy about it. But then they realized it was not. And that was one of the things that that these things are basically a burden. And that affected Gorbachev quite a bit. And he basically changed the ideology. So containment worked best when it failed.
What role does threat inflation play in this? Because that seems to be a pretty common thing in Washington. And there's, you know, as we're recording this, we're waiting for the FDA to decide if it's going to let people start taking the Johnson & Johnson vaccine again. And there's lots of criticism of this decision on the grounds that there's a vanishingly small threat that is likely much smaller than other threats, but the FDA's incentives are to latch on to small threats and respond to those and to kind of act as if they're bigger because they're the threats in its, you know, in its wheelhouse, I suppose. And there's something similar happens, it seems like, in foreign policy. So what is threat inflation, and does it play a part in this story, both in the story of convincing us that war is stupid because we've seen threats inflated, but maybe also in convincing us it's not because we've been told that threats are bigger than they are?
Yeah, well, one of the main themes of the book is looking at threat inflation. And one of the ones I just was mentioned that the idea they vastly inflated the threat that the Soviet Union was willing to start World War III, for example. And we now have, you know, they had to be careful at the time, and who knows, you know, you have limited evidence and so forth, but we know a lot more now. And basically, there was no danger of war, even on the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. That basically is continuing, and I think we're continuing to inflate threat. Terrorism after 9/11 in particular was pretty terrible, but I've written a lot about that in this book and other books. That we massively inflated the degree to which international terrorism is a threat. 9/11 was a horror, but it stands out as being an extreme outlier. There's never been another terrorist event before or after 9/11 in war zones or outside war zones that inflicted even one-tenth as much total destruction. So by seeing that as the wave of the future, which is a standard belief right after 9/11 in the intelligence community, was basically nonsense. And it impelled us into these two sort of preventive wars, supposedly, in Afghanistan and Iraq, which would never have happened without it. And currently, the book also deals with current threats. And it seems to be that the big two that people worry about are Russia and China, both of those growing in concern within the Beltway. And I just think it's nonsense. Both countries obviously want to feel their weight. Both countries are certainly doing things from a civil liberty standpoint, which are reprehensible, also from an economic liberty standpoint, foolish. But they aren't expansionary in the sense of Hitler wanting to take over new territory, with the exception of China wanting to get Taiwan back. So while they're a pain in the neck, and there's definitely parts of their policy that I certainly find abhorrent, as do most other Americans. Nonetheless, it's not a threat, and not a security threat. And dealing with it, and the same thing with nuclear proliferation. It's not clear that that makes much difference if Korea has a bomb, North Korea has a bomb or not. It's not clear that that's really a problem overall. So you can deal with it calmly, even complacently, as says in the subtitle of the book, because I don't think we have security threats that require much more than that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, because at the beginning I said there are two controversial statements in the title, The Stupidity of War and Complacency, The Case for Complacency. I mean, it's interesting because that has been the kind of attack that you lob on someone who criticizes American foreign policy. Being complacent is something that you cannot be. Now, again, you know, we know from hindsight a bunch of these things were not as big of threats. But, you know, I remember after 9/11, anyone would have said that there would have been another terrorist attack within the next 5 years. People would have put a lot of money saying that there would have been another big one. So when it comes to complacency, like North Korea and a nuclear weapon, I mean, we don't want nuclear weapons in the hands of completely maniacal dictators, it would seem to me. So like, I mean, maybe complacency when it comes to some of these threats, but like when it comes to ones that could turn really serious, like, is there still a case for complacency?
Well, there's been no more maniacal dictator than Joseph Stalin. And he was also going crazy at the end, or Mao Zedong. Just because they're maniacal dictators doesn't mean they use the weapons. The North Korean weapon is mostly obviously to deter the United States, who's threatened to wipe it out repeatedly. Rid the world of evil is George W. Bush. And I'll also tell you where the evil is. North Korea, Iraq, and Iran. So the North Koreans obviously got a bit exercised about that. So I don't, the problem with the atomic obsession, as they call it, is that worrying so much about proliferation kills people. The war in Iraq has killed hundreds of thousands of people, and it was an anti-proliferation war. So nuclear weapons have killed nobody since 1945, but efforts to stop them have killed hundreds of thousands of people, stop them from proliferating. So being complacent in the case of North Korea, there's no way you're going to negotiate those out. They think they need them for their security. What you can do is try to help North Korea become a normal country. I think there's some real possibilities under Kim Jong-un. He's actually reversed previous policy in that way. So I think there's distinct possibilities. Other places like Afghanistan, the Russians and the Chinese want to play a bigger role in the world. And the question is, why not bring them in on Afghanistan? They don't want Afghanistan to be unstable. They're as worried about Islamist extremists as anybody in the world, because they have problems with it in their own countries, they think. So why not bring them in? Why not work with Russia to try to stabilize the situation in Syria, the disaster? Assad now has won, and one possibility is to try to work to stabilize that situation as much as possible, allow refugees to go back, and work with Assad, or against Assad, if necessary, with the Russians, to keep him from engaging in, you know, vengeful actions. So the point is, working with these people, obviously you have to work with them on other things, such as pandemics, refugees, global warming, and so forth. There are a lot of other places where they could be useful. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But it seems to me they should be tried. They should not be seen as enemies, I think, overall. They are opponents. They may be competitors in some sense or other. But I don't think they're out to take over the world. They may want to play a bigger role in it. They certainly want to develop economically. And I don't see those as being necessarily terrible goals.
It seems weird that... almost the inverse. If you speak to a standard, I mean, not even just a conservative, like a mainstream liberal, most of them would say, over the post-war period, America's military strength was paramount to keeping the world order in check, keeping communists in check, protecting Western Europe, making sure we didn't have communism run across South America, you name it. And it seems that your thesis is radically the opposite, to the point that, you know, to have people scratching their heads, essentially that, except for maybe North Korea, if America did nothing, if our military was, you know, the size, $100 billion a year, you know, a fraction of what it is now, if America did nothing, things wouldn't have been radically different in terms of the world order. But, you know, except for, you know, we'd have fewer people dead in Vietnam and stuff like that. But I mean, is that essentially that everything kind of played itself out and American military prowess kind of did nothing in that equation in the post-war period?
Yeah, well, that's one of the themes of the book. It's not clear that American military has been necessary. Its one achievement was, as you say, keeping South Korea from being taken over by the communists. And that's why it seems to me that might have been a war worth fighting. But otherwise, the idea that, for example, France and Germany would have gone to war but for the United States is absurd. You know, what you have to do is find me somebody in France, somebody in Germany over the last 75 years who's gotten on a soapbox and said, we used to be so good at getting into wars. Let's do it again. So the idea that you have to have a security community or a coal and steel community or the Americans or NATO or anything to stop them from going to war is basically absurd, it seems to me. In case of the coal and steel community, which of course led into the common market and so forth, was mainly an anti-war thing. In other words, they had the coal and steel community because they wanted to reduce the danger of war. My opinion is that basically because they didn't want to go to war, things like the coal and steel community is something you could seriously consider, integrating the economies in one way or the other, to everybody's mutual advantage. So what happens is if war basically becomes extremely unlikely, then certain things happen. Like you might go over there and see if they have something you want to buy or sell. Maybe you'll cut a deal, maybe not. If you think you're going to go to war with them every 5 years or every 10 years, then obviously that's a real stricture on what the economic development. So it's not at all clear that anybody would have gone to war if because of the United States. Europe has remained peaceful because Europe wanted to be peaceful. The Soviet Union never had any idea of starting another war. And it's not clear that other places, in the case of Vietnam, the United States might have kept Vietnam from falling to the communists in 1965. Instead, it fell in 1975. And of course, now, by the way, Vietnam is sort of our bosom buddy in that area. So it's not at all clear that we need the United States for Pax Americana. And people who say otherwise have to show me exactly where two countries about ready to go to war, Turkey and Greece, maybe, where they basically saw that. And the United States stepped in and said, no, you're not going to war. I think it's very hard to find anything like that.
But maybe there's a case that we might not have examples of the United States explicitly stepping in and saying, hey, knock it off, guys. The very presence of not just that the United States is there with a large military, but that the United States has a history of actually using it acts as a deterrent to them even getting to the point where we need to get between them and separate them.
What country are you talking about?
I'm thinking of, the examples that I've heard people talk about would be, so Iran wanting to take over more of the Middle East, Iraq that, did invade its neighbor, possibly India and Pakistan. China might, have longer term plans to be a little bit more ambitious, like what they're doing in Hong Kong and what they might do to Taiwan, like those sorts of things that maybe just the United States and its history of using its muscle is kind of preventing them from like wanting to go to war in the first place.
Yep. You have to see where that's true. In the case of Iran, they obviously want to play a bigger role in the Middle East and they have their own, groups that they prefer and so forth. And they seem, whatever the United States does, they seem to have been able to do that. The United States has tried to punish them, not with military force so much, but with sanctions. And that does not seem to have changed their policy in the slightest. So it's not clear that any of that makes that much difference.
On the Taiwan point, though, this one seems to be pretty salient because we know Xi Jinping's writing has made explicit that part of the designs is to take Taiwan back for China. We know that. And it seems to me that the biggest thing that would be keeping them from doing that is wondering whether or not we would get involved. And that only matters because we have a significant enough military that it would matter if we got involved.
Yeah, well, the biggest thing actually would be what would happen to its own reputation and its own economy if we were to do that. The Russians were able to take over Crimea in 2014. And they may have gained some territory, but it certainly didn't do them any good economically. And they got really hit by a lot of stuff, much of it natural in the sense that people trust them less, are willing to invest less, more people get money out of the country, capital flight and so forth. And I think China would have to worry about that big time. Taiwan is probably pretty capable of defending itself. There's only a few beaches where you can land a landing force. And amphibious landings is probably the hardest tactic in warfare and fails more often than anything else. So I think you're right, basically, to point to that as a problem. The ambiguity of the American entrance probably does play into the Chinese hands. But they've long said, basically, that we think long-term on this. We got a long, 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 long history. And eventually we want these guys to come around. And the question now is whether they really want to do it very soon. I'm not sure, but I think pretty much that they don't. The cost of doing so with their untried and extremely corrupt military would be very high, even if they are successful, and even if the United States didn't intervene. Furthermore, if they did intervene and the United States didn't directly get involved, it could do other things like harassing, like sanctions, like supporting rebels within Taiwan. It's also the case that the Chinese had a lot of difficulty containing secessionist elements and anti-China elements within Hong Kong. If they now take over Taiwan, they're going to have a much bigger problem along that line. They have to finesse that too. So there's a lot of things that can deter them from going. The Taiwanese also have very good early warning systems, et cetera, et cetera. They are obviously much smaller, but the Chinese military is pretty much untested. The last time it fought a war was in 1979 against North Vietnam, and it did not go very well. So there's various things, reasons you can think of that. But I think that is by far the most important area of concern in terms of potential warfare. The Taiwan thing, which I mentioned earlier on.
One of the things that we've seen in the last 5 years is a kind of collapsing of the previous agreement that free trade is a good thing. And I had sort of thought that we reached a point that we all kind of came around to understand that free trade was a good thing, and now that is not the case anymore. And part of some of the things that animate anti-free trade arguments, nationalism, you know, desire to help your people over other people, are similar to the kind of things that animate war in many ways. So in this sort of increasingly nationalistic world, at least in terms of trade, but also in a variety of different ways, does it concern you that maybe this conclusion that so much of humanity has reached that war is stupid is as fragile going forward as, say, the free trade consensus that did exist, that this is not something that we can rest assured will stick around?
Yeah, that's why people dislike the argument, because, you know, if Hitler could start a war, why can't someone else? If people can decide war is a really bad idea, why can't they just as quickly decide it's a good one? And I have no answer to that, because I don't know. Things do change. Skirt lengths go up and down. They don't only go up and they don't only go down. Baseball caps get worn backwards and frontwards, you know, at various times. So I can't be certain. It is only what I'm basically arguing. It's only been a matter of change of opinion. On the other hand, there was a big change of opinion on slavery. In over 100 years, formal slavery, at least, was limited from what was then known as Christendom. And you don't see that coming back. There is informal slavery, there's illegal slavery and stuff, and human trafficking and so forth. But you can't go to New Orleans and buy somebody. No one is saying, you know, that was really good when we used to be able to buy people in New Orleans. They put them on there and we look them over and so forth. And you have this property and you can sell it or you can keep it or whatever. It doesn't come back. And similarly with dueling. I mean, the causes for dueling are the same as they've ever been. Egos in particular. People get very mad, young men in particular. They don't duel, except at least in the formal sense. So you'd have some with like sort of street gangs with being disrespected and so forth. So the point is that, the bustle hasn't come back. And the corset hasn't come back. So certain ideas die out. Infanticide, the old-fashioned infanticide, obviously has been gone for a very long time. Steve Pinker has a whole book or two books now, basically tracing the decline of various kinds of violence around the world, and also Mary Tupi at Cato. So what happens is that some things really do go out of fashion. They never come back. You could argue that abortion is a form of high-tech infanticide, and to a degree, infanticide in that sense has come back. At one time, it was basically inconceivable that you could have legal abortion, of course, since the 70s, that's changed. So ideas go back and forth. And what people like would be to say that, well, if you reach a certain level GDP per capita or something, you don't go to war. That as long as you stay above that, you're okay. In other words, it's determined by GDP per capita or something else, something you really measure and get your hands on. But in my view, that's not true. It's basically simply a matter of people changing attitudes. But I do want to say, as with slavery and dueling, sometimes ideas can die out and never come back.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, make sure to rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Landry Ayers. If you'd like to learn more about libertarianism, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.